How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I am fantabulous. How are you?
Ooh, I'm doing great.
I say that every week, but it doesn't really matter if I am or not.
But
I'm
you
here.
Are.
I'm here. So you there's are. That. There
you
is
showed
that.
Up. That's
I did. I showed up for
80%.
The party.
That's 80% of the job.
That is true.
Yeah.
So you ready for today's case?
I am. Let's dig into it.
It's local. It is local. Mm-hmm. So local yokel. So here we go. You ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
Today we are venturing back to a time when small towns had small town doctors. These doctors were fixtures of the community. These men and women made house calls and knew all their patients and their ailments. If Mr. Smith couldn't pay, no problem. If Mrs. Jones' infant spiked a fever in the middle of the night, the doctor would be there within the hour. No. These doctors took an oath of do no harm, but maybe, just maybe, not all doctors are good. In fact, maybe there are a few doctors whose bedside manner is more like dead side manner. This.
Jesus.
You're not supposed to laugh. I love that. This is one such doctor. I was going to name the episode this. It is December 13th, 1984. A man, looking over his farming fields, sees something in the grass. Not sure what it is, he gets out of his car to take a closer look. As soon as he approaches, he knows it is not good. It is a man with what appears to be gunshots to the head. He leaves the scene and calls police. Now, the area where the man was located was a small town outside of St. Louis, and you're going to dig this, Jen, called Times Beach.
Oh, yes, Times Beach. It's radioactive.
So I went down that rabbit hole because we were in high school, but I don't really remember all this. So for those of you from this area, you will be familiar with Times Beach.
Mm-hmm. It's right past Six Flags.
I was just going to say, Times Beach is located right outside of Eureka. Before you get into, I would say, Valley Park, Fenton area. In 1983, the EPA came in and they demanded that the entire town, with a population of around, it wasn't that much, less than 2,000, somewhere in there, had to be evacuated. Mm-hmm. It seems that the land had been contaminated with extremely high levels of dioxin. Now, this dioxin is known to cause cancer, but what is dioxin? So, of course, I look all that up because I forgot about all this. I mean, I remember, but I forgot it. Dioxin is a toxic compound produced as a byproduct in some manufacturing processes, notably herbicide production and paper bleaching. It was the largest civilian exposure to the compound in the history of the United States. Can you believe that? I had no idea. I mean, that's huge.
I remember that. It was the home of the six-legged toads.
Oh, for real?
For real.
Yeah. I just remember as a kid, it was like all the talk. So like when you're going down Highway 44, which is a major highway here from St. Louis out to, I guess, Rolla, Springfield, you go down that way. It just overnight closed. Like everybody was gone. Everything was boarded up. Yeah.
Do you remember there was a boy that transferred into our school and everybody was kind of afraid of him because he was from Times Beach?
So the government moved everybody out and it was cleaned up and now it has reopened as a park. There's biking trails and things like that, which I guess it's cleaned up. Who knows?
It is. Yeah. It's cleaned up. They cleaned it up within 10. I think there was a certain period of time where it had to stay dormant.
Yeah. It was quick.
Right. But then it's opened back up in the past 10, 15 years, I believe.
Mm-mm. It opened up within like 3 or 4 years.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, I thought it was a while back.
It was interesting, too. It was a man that had basically, in an effort to calm the dirt roads, Time Beach was tiny, so they had dirt roads, so that created a lot of dust. Well, mm-hmm. he had this agent that he would spray to quill the dust, bring the dust down, and this was that agent. Well, it put poison all over, mm-hmm. so I had no idea. Police arrived to the location where the body was found. They find a man lying on his back with 2 bullet wounds from a .357 Magnum to the back of the head, with an exit wound right above his left eye. Because the man is still warm to the touch, investigators know he has not been dead too long, and estimate the time of death somewhere between 5 a.m. and 7 a.m. Even though the man was dressed, he had no ID on him. However, when the deceased man's fingerprints are plugged into the system, they get a hit. The man is 22-year-old Sean Cavaness. Police locate his brother and bring him into the station, breaking the devastating news to him. Understandably, his brother, Kevin, is beside himself when he heard that his brother was not only dead, but seemingly had been murdered. The questions start coming. Who would kill Sean, and why? Everyone liked Sean. He didn't run with the rough crowd, and he stayed away from drugs. However, he did suffer from a bit of depression, and he took to the bottle to fix it. He was, by all accounts, a good guy. Sean had moved to the St. Louis area when his parents, Dr. John Dale Cavaness, and his mother divorced. Through the tears, Kevin mumbles something, something that officers can hardly understand or believe. Kevin states that this is his second brother to die in a violent way. Kevin tells police that his other brother, Mark, was shot and killed in 1977. At the time, he was working on the family farm, and the medical examiner cited the death as an accidental death. While this doesn't automatically mean there's something fishy going on, it definitely does mean it's a strange occurrence at best. Two brothers die from a gunshot wound?
Yeah, it's a little bit suspicious.
When investigators dig in and start making phone calls to people, they learn that the family was loved by the community and didn't seem to have issues that would make them a target. You know, I have to interject here and say this is the early 1980s. St. Louis has always been a hotbed for drugs, gang violence, and things like that. But in the 80s, it was, you know, that's when crack, meth wasn't on scene yet. It was crack, cocaine, things like that were making the scene. So it was pretty violent, much kind of like it is today.
I think it's worse than it.
You think it's
today
worse today
than it was? Mm-hmm. Oh, I do. Definitely.
Officers decide to go to Sean's apartment to see if they can find anything that may shed some light on what was going on in his life. While they're there, they reach out and they talk to neighbors. A couple that lived below Sean told officers that the night before he went missing, they noticed a car circling in the area. It made him so nervous that, well, it made him nervous enough to get out a pen and take down the license plate.
Oh, smart thinking.
Back at the station, officers run the plate and make an interesting discovery. The car belongs to none other than Sean's father, Dr. Cavaness. Dr. Cavaness was a highly respected doctor whose office was in southern Illinois, a small area known as Little Egypt. Now, if you're familiar with this area, a lot of southern towns, right, Jen, in Illinois have sort of an Egyptian name.
Yes, but there's a town called that is spelled like Cairo, but in the good old southern Illinois, Missouri way, we call it Cairo.
And there's several towns that have an Egyptian name.
Yeah, I think there's
name.
Is it Goshen or they call it Goshen? I can't remember, but yeah, right off the bat, there's a bunch of them.
I've driven through there and I was little. That's all. And I was enamored because I thought we were in Egypt. That's all I remember about that. I don't remember anything else.
Yeah,
Egypt, nope. Right across the river.
Nope. That was part of my territory when I sold books for Scholastic Book Fairs. So
patients in southern Illinois adored Dr. Cavaness. They used him all the time, having babies, growing up, elderly parents. Everybody adored him. But as we all know, Jen, sometimes things are not always what they seem. The good doctor was raised in that same area by a loving mother and father who demanded a strong man for a son. Now, even though times were tough, they managed to stash away enough money to send John to medical school. During medical school, he met and married his first wife, but that didn't last long. When medical school was completed, he moved back to his hometown to practice medicine there. He soon met his second wife, a nurse named Marion. The union would produce four sons, but the facade was cracking. Dr. Dale, as his patients would call him, started using alcohol and drugs, and in fact became abusive when he did. His second wife soon became the target of his frustrations, and he began to physically and emotionally abuse her. This occurred about the same time that he started using alcohol and drugs heavily. The drug abuse would lead to the first tragedy of the story. In 1972, Dr. Cavaness was drunk when his car caused a three-car accident. The crash left a man and his 10-month-old baby girl dead.
That's heartbreaking.
He pleaded guilty to reckless homicide, driving while intoxicated, and unlawful possession of a loaded pistol and shotgun. For this, he would only receive 2 years of probation and a $1,000 fine. Mm-hmm. No jail time.
Sounds about right.
1972, I guess that's on par. I would think today he would do much, much more time, at least.
I wouldn't count on that, but
really?
Sure. I don't know.
No?
It's hard to say.
It was right around this time that his wife, Marion, had had enough, and she left him. She would move to the St. Louis area. Now, divorce is never easy. We both know that. But it had hit the eldest son, Mark, harder than the other boys. Mark ended up dropping out of high school, and his dominant medical father was incensed by this move. His father would call him a no-good pot smoker. And I wanted to interject, hippie, because...
dirty hippie. Yep.
That's what I thought. And that he was a loser. He'd never make anything out of his life. He was going to amount to nothing.
Nice parroting skills right there.
Mark became a target for his father, and Mark was sent into a deep depression over the harassment and from the divorce. Everything was adding up. He was a young kid. In 1977, Mark, who was not quite 22 years old, started working at his father's farm in Little Egypt. Mark did all the things and the handiwork that the farm needed. Fixed the doors, you know, mow, whatever needed to be done. Handiwork, because he did quit high school. He really didn't have skills, but, you know, he was helping out where he could. Prior to Easter weekend, Mark wanted to see his mom and his brother, so he invited them over to the farm for the weekend. Now, at this point, his mother decided that this would be the perfect time to reach out to Mark and try to talk him into coming to St. Louis to get some therapy, to get some help for his mental issues, his alcohol dependency, all of that stuff. So it was all set up. Mark would return to St. Louis after that weekend, but Mark failed to show up. On April 9th, 1977, Marion, 15-year-old Sean, and 19-year-old Kevin, these are the brothers, headed out to the trailer where Mark was living on his father's farm to see if he was there. They found his Jeep pickup, and Sean was walking up to it as he discovered the decaying corpse of his older brother. His brother was lying in the tall grass near the truck. Sadly, there was not much left of Mark as the animals had already gotten to the body.
How awful to have to discover your family member.
That would be a lifelong nightmare. That would be, I don't even know if therapy could get you through that.
I don't think it could.
And remember, Sean's only 15. I mean, he's a baby. Sean could only identify Mark by the belt buckle he always wore. The only way to positively identify Mark was through dental records. Mark was lying face up, and you got to kind of understand the setup here to understand what's going on. Mark was laying face up and was located about 12 feet from his truck. His feet were pointed towards the truck as if he were walking to the truck and then fell backwards. Due to the condition of the body, investigators could not determine if he was walking to or from the truck. You know, sometimes when you're hit by a bullet, depending on where you are, if you fall backwards or forwards. I guess the only true determinant is the bullet exit and entry wound.
Right. If it goes in one way, it's the hole is smaller than where it exits.
Mark's shirt was found off of his body, but due to the bullet hole in the shirt, the bullet holes, they believe he was wearing it at the time he was shot. Now, I couldn't really find anything here, but I believe that they surmised, thanks, Chris, that the animals that had gotten to the body had, you know, taken the shirt off of him and dragged it away from his body. It was determined that Mark was shot by a 12-gauge shotgun. The truck had blood all throughout it. Now, due to this, the police believe that Mark had reached inside. This was the theory at the time. that Mark reached inside his truck for the gun and was pulling it out by the barrel. And when he did, he had a hanger with like a hunting vest. This is, you know, Southern Illinois, Missouri. It's the Midwest. Well, hunting's big everywhere, I guess, but it's really big here. He had a hunting vest on a hanger. And when he was pulling it out by the barrel, the hanger lodged inside next to the trigger. As he was pulling it out, the trigger got stuck on the hanger inside the vehicle, causing the firearm to discharge, right?
So an accidental death.
Correct.
By his own hand, right.
Since his wallet was on scene, robbery was ruled out. At the time, police believed the circumstances were strange at best, but with little evidence, they filed the death, as you said, as accidental. Now, brother Kevin was adamant that Mark was way too much of a gun expert to allow something this foolish to happen, to occur. He knew gun safety. He would have never done this. He would have never pulled out a giant gun by the barrel towards his body. He believed there was much more to the story. The story would stick, Jen. For now, that is. In 1980, Dr. Cavanis would find himself in more legal trouble. Seems like the small-town doctor was committing medical fraud.
Color me shocked.
He pleaded guilty to deceptive medical practice. Dr. Dale talked to his sons, Kevin and Sean, and you know, as if he didn't have enough of this, he talked them into assisting him in what was now his new devious plan. He told the sons that if they would help him out with his, quote, insurance investment, wink, wink, he would help them out in the future. The doctor would pay the $1,000 monthly premium and file this as a tax deduction. The only thing at this point, Dr. Dale was out of control with his drug abuse. He was in debt deep, and no amount of tax deductions were going to help anyone, much less himself. In fact, at this point, Jen, he was almost $500,000. That's $500,000 in debt.
Wow. That's kind of scary.
So what does an in-debt doctor do? You know.
Mm-hmm. Insurance money. Doesn't even have to be a doctor. It could be anybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody loves that insurance cash out.
Tell you. At this point in time, Sean was fighting his own demons. Now, Sean's the baby that found his older brother deceased. He was fighting with drug and alcohol abuse, but unlike his brother Mark, he desperately wanted his father's attention and approval. You know, Mark kind of, as an older, the older boy, we know this, sort of did his own thing. He didn't care that his dad didn't like him. His dad was cruel to him. His dad said mean things. Little Sean, he wanted that approval, much, you know, the hierarchy of the siblings and how they fall in order in the family. Sometimes that changes things. At this point in time, Sean was fighting his own demons with drugs and alcohol. But unlike his brother Mark, he desperately wanted his father's attention and approval. Now, if you remember, Mark was kind of a rebel. He was the older boy. He quit high school. He didn't really care what his father thought. Sean, on the other hand, he wanted help. He wanted to be better. And he wanted that approval, I guess you can say, mm-hmm. from his father. Dr. Dale didn't treat Sean much better than Mark. But unlike Mark, Sean wanted to get better and he sought treatment. He wanted to get into the 12-step program. He wanted to be a better person. He wanted to get better and he wanted to be better. But just like Mark, he would not have the chance. This brings us up to where we started. An autopsy on Sean would reveal a few things. Sean had consumed quite a few drinks prior to his death. And when I say quite a few, I'm talking 12 plus. And this would be enough that he would be considered pretty drunk.
I would be extremely drunk with 12 beers. So, yeah.
It just says 12 drinks. It could have been hard.
12 drinks. It could have been.
I don't know.
That's true. It's a beer town. Come on, it's St. Louis. It's close. It's a Budweiser.
It's true.
You know it is.
Thankfully, Sean's death would provide a bit more than his brother's death did. Since Sean's neighbor had told police about the car hanging out around the apartment the evening before Sean died, authorities knew that they had to talk to Dr. Dale. Police bring in Dr. Dale, as they have more than a few questions for him. And let's just say Dr. Dale, well, his pants are on fire, Jen. You know what I'm saying.
Big
you
liar. Know what I'm saying? Dirty, rotten liar.
Sometimes I just wonder if these people hear what they're saying.
I don't think they care. That's the point. They really
This was
don't.
An educated man. He's got a medical degree.
Doesn't matter. They
I
don't
guess
care.
Not. Dr. Dale.
Deceptive medical practices. Yeah.
Deceptive Dale. Let's call him Deceptive Dr. Dale. DDD. Dr. Dale tells police that he had not seen Sean in weeks, several weeks, as a matter of fact. The officers say, wrong. We have an eyewitness that not only say that you were cruising around his apartment that night, that they felt the need to write down the license plate for police. They were sure it was someone up to no good. However, when they saw the person who they know was you and the other person walk up to you, hug Sean, they realized, oh, this must be somebody that Sean knows or knew. And so, therefore, they put it out of their mind. They didn't call authorities. They figured it was Sean and his friend or whoever. They did not, at that point, know it was his dad. Investigators also learned that less than 20 hours after the death of Sean, on the evening, and you can't make this up, on the evening of December 14th, Dr. Dale, he goes to a Christmas party, Jen.
Oh, good.
He goes to a Christmas party less than 24 hours after his son had committed suicide. So we find out in a minute. By all the guests that were attending the party, they mentioned what a great time the doctor had. He was socializing and partying, just like, well, a man attending a holiday party who did not witness his son die by suicide just hours earlier. Now, we all grieve differently. I think we can all attest to that.
But this one, but that's not grieving.
This one takes the fruitcake, if you know what I'm saying, because this is Christmas. So that's a giant, nope. Then again,
red flag, dropping those red flags everywhere.
Everywhere. Then again, maybe Dr. Dale was used to having a son violently die since this was son number two. Police badger him, and then Dr. Dale comes up with yet another story. Okay, I told you the wrong story. Okay, here's the truth. Here's the truth of what happened. Dr. Dale tells authorities that he did go over and visit Sean, just like those witnesses had stated. And the two of them, they started drinking, and they started drinking heavily. And what does wanna do when they start drinking? Go for a drive. That's right. So they go to a drive and they went to a nearby park. This park, incidentally, is where Sean would succumb to his death. And once there, Sean wanted to see Dr. Dale's gun, wanted to see his dad's gun. Hey, can I see your gun? Sean had the gun, then held it up to his head, and he allegedly said, tell mom I'm sorry, and shot himself in the head. Dr. Dale didn't stop there with this story. He tells officers he knew that Sean's suicide would just simply crush his mother. Just crush her. So he didn't want it to be a suicide, so he made it look like a robbery gone wrong. To make it even more convincing, Dr. Dale decided to put yet another bullet into his son. You know, to make it look more real.
Oh,
Dr. Dale,
nice of him.
Dr. Dale then took his dead son's watch and wallet to complete the robbery. Only issue, Jen. Here's the thing.
Oh, the only issue with this?
Yeah. We got lots of issues, but
no, there's more than just,
Big issue, Jen, is that there's a thing called evidence, ballistics, you know, all that fancy police stuff. And Dr. Dale's story did not match the crime scene. Let's go back.
I'm shocked.
We're rewinding right there. First off, Sean was quite drunk at the time of death. So drunk, in fact, experts would testify that he was, that had he shot himself, he was way too drunk to do so. It would not be a clean shot. He was shaky, and he would have an inability to hold the gun steady enough to make such a clean shot like this was. Secondly, the blood splatter evidence, thank you, Dexter, indicated that Sean's self-inflicted gunshot wound would have had to have happened when he was already on the ground. So why is he lying on the ground if he's going to shoot himself?
Mm-hmm.
When Dr. Dale, his dad, says that it was
otherwise, yeah. Huh. Wonder
gets
what
better,
the police
Jen.
Will do.
Gets better. I don't know how these guys act when they're hearing these stories. Because I can't, sometimes my face can't lie. And I'd be like, are you kidding me, right? I digress. Back to the story. But what the police would discover next left no room for interpretation. Seems like the good doctor, who was in a heap of debt, as I had mentioned earlier, had taken out a life insurance policy on Sean.
I'm shocked. Shocked, I say. Clutch those pearls.
Wait, yeah. Jen, clutch your pearls again. He had also taken out one on Mark years earlier. Mark.
Wow.
Right? Mark, the first son.
I'm shocked.
Mark had a $40,000 policy on him, while Sean's policy was near $150,000. Now, this is in the 80s. So that's a lot of money.
$500,000? I just looked it up. $500,000 in 1980 was $1,705,995 today.
So that's what he was in debt.
That's what he owed. Yeah, that's his debt. Mm-hmm. Almost $2 million.
Dr. John Dale Cavanaugh murdered both of his sons simply for money. Mm-hmm. Is that heartbreaking or is that heartbreaking?
Oh, there's a special place in hell for people that kill their kids, period. But this crap? No. He only got paid out $341,000 for the death of the second son.
Yeah, and...
Yeah.
And he got caught. The revelation, as you can imagine, we both grew up in a small town. It split the town. Part of the town folk, they believed, I mean, this is the guy that would come in the middle
They're
of the
loyal
night.
To him.
They're, mm-hmm. they're sick babies. He took care of them. And by all standards, he was a loving doctor. He was just a not loving person to
a
his
dick.
Family.
He was okay, a dick.
See, that, yeah. I was not going to say that, but I was going to say he was an asshole. But that's okay. You can go that way if you want.
And I'm sure he was sweet to patients who couldn't afford that they'd pay him in chicken eggs or something. Mm-hmm. And that's probably half the reason why he was $2 million in debt.
Correct. The man who so lovingly took care of them when they were ill could never be so cruel to murder his very own children. In fact, the town, the ones that supported him, rallied and they set up a defense fund to help the cost of the trial. Can you imagine?
It's an early GoFundMe.
I get yeah. Well, yeah, they didn't have that then.
Well, you don't want to see your heroes fall, right? I mean, there's some people that think OJ didn't do it.
Fallible. So, yeah.
It is. But, I mean, trying to say, you know, you go for this person saved my child's life, but then turned around and killed his.
But it's not just one child, Jen. It's two. He didn't even toss it up. He didn't even... You know,
but what
mix
I'm
it up
saying,
with, like, poisons or car accident. No, he just shot them both.
But what I'm saying is people are not going to believe that because he was so kind and caring to their child, who he was not related to.
Correct.
How would he turn around and kill his children?
I think that would be. I mean, think about your doctor growing up, my doctor.
Not my dentist. I hated my dentist.
There you go. Well, Jen, they could have raised $1 million. It would not have mattered much. During the trial, a few things were brought up that shed some light on the real Dr. Dale. Kevin, his own son, testified that once he had learned that his father was involved in a drug deal, he confronted him. And his dad, his very own dad, threatened, quote, "If you tell anyone, I'll kill you," end quote. Now, that should have been a sign right there. He's already killed two kids. It didn't matter to him. During the first trial, it ended in a mistrial when the judge determined that the jury had seen documents that were not supposed to be introduced as evidence. During the second trial, there was a resolution, thankfully. The jury deliberated less than 3 hours. Dr. Dale, age 60, was convicted on first-degree murder in the death of his son, Sean. Dr. Dale showed no emotion as the verdict was read. In January 1986, Dr. John Dale Cavanaugh was handed a death sentence for the murder of Sean Cavanaugh. The doctor who practiced saving lives would now be facing the gas chamber.
Good. Not sad about that at all.
And here's the end note. As it so often ends like this, the doctor didn't even make it a year. Maybe he was sorry for what he did, or maybe he just could not take prison life. Dr. John Dale Cavanaugh hanged himself in his death row cell by fashioning an electrical cord into a noose. He was 61 years old.
That's how it goes, isn't it?
There is a book called Murder in Little Egypt. You can check that out. I remember, I think I said this at the beginning, that we
talked about it, yeah.
We worked. Jen and I worked in a bookstore, and I remember there were a couple books that were big that, you know, you'd front in the... You know, the slang in the book or, you know, retail, you know, you pull them towards the front, you can see it. You know what I'm saying?
You face the...
Face it.
You make it so the cover showed, so it's easier for people to find.
Yeah. And so I remember this. Also, In Broad Daylight, which was the Ken...
Local titles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So Murder in Little Egypt is by Darcy O'Brien, and that's O'Brien.
Is it still in print?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Must be a regional thing now.
Yeah. There's a lot to it. It's just so interesting to me that you have this guy that saves lives and helps, I don't know, and then you kill your very own blood. What?
Your
what
sons.
What are you doing? Your babies, your kids.
Well, he was working his way to all of them. He only killed half of them.
Shame.
And then what made, no, but I'm just saying, what would make you.
Like, which ones
why
to pick?
Those two?
That's yes. what I was thinking. Well, the
it's
first
like the
one,
ones, the Munchausens by proxy. Mm-hmm, they have four mm-hmm. kids, but they hone yep. in on one child.
Yep, I agree.
I think
there has to be something in their personality. Mark, I think, was kind of a free spirit and stuff, and he didn't like that. And then the baby, Sean, I don't know. Terrible. Easy
access.
Yeah. Probably to get mm-hmm. what he wanted. But I can't, and I've said it before on the podcast, there is, I think, to kill your own child has to be the worst. Any child killer is the worst, period.
Family annihilators are despicable.
I think they lose their marbles or something. I don't know.
To kill your own flesh and blood.
I'm not a doctor and I don't play one on TV, but I know that is not normal. So yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Unreal.
That's right. All right.
Well, good one.
That's very interesting. Check it out.
Mm-hmm. I remember there's not much to Cairo, if I recall. So there are some pretty nice, neat looking buildings because of they're so old that like the architecture is pretty cool.
It's close to the river, correct?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. it was shipping and things like that. Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing back like these towns that were so big back in the day? I mean, St. Louis was New York back in the day.
Right.
With the Mississippi River. And then now it's just St. Louis.
No, it is.
It is.
So what have you been watching? Anything good?
Yes. Something. Okay. Inventing Anna. It's on Netflix. Have you seen it? Anna?
No.
Delphi. Mm-mm. Okay. Here's the thing. So actually, because I was thinking about this, I think when you and I were going to CrimeCon one year, we listened to this podcast about a girl that swindled her friend. They went on vacation. Once they got there, I believe it was Morocco, she didn't have a credit card. And she was like, well, I'll pay you. It's okay. I'll pay you. So the little girl paid and it was $65,000. That's what they racked up. Anna Delvey has quite the story. A couple months ago on 2020, they interviewed her and she is, I don't even know what to say. You have to watch it. The interview is very, she is unforgiving. She's very unapologetic. She doesn't care. And in a way, I admire her strength and that she wanted to accomplish great things. However, she did not do it the right way. So anyway, on Netflix with Julia Garner, I believe is her last name, from Ozark, plays her. Uh-huh. And boy, I think she...
Oh, so it's not a documentary. It's an actual...
It is, but
like
it's all
movie.
It is based on everything.
Gotcha.
Like it's based on her story. There's something really cute and unique, and I won't tell you, at the beginning of every episode, and they tie it in every episode.
Cool.
It's cute.
Yeah, I'll have to look at
so
it.
So check that out.
I'll have
it's
to
good.
Watch it. Yeah, I really haven't good. Really... I finished Yellow Jackets, and I absolutely loved it. I can't wait for second season. And if you haven't watched it and you didn't know that there'd be a second season, I'm sorry. Spoiler alert. Hashtag spoiler alert.
But those actresses, though, you knew that they had a second season.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. But still, there are some people like my husband. Granted, it is my husband. But he's like, you mean there's going to be like we watched the whole thing and he's like, there better not be a second season. And I'm like, oh, he's going to hate this because he
there
needs
is?
To get there's going to be a second. Yeah. I want to watch. Did you see the Twitter? Oh, not the Twitter. What
Tinder,
am I?
Tinder Swindler.
Yes. Have you watched that?
Do you think I've watched that, Jen?
Oh, no. I know you have.
I watched it last weekend. Of course.
I don't know where you find the time to watch all this show.
Tell me about it.
I really
it.
Don't.
I don't know. Well, it was on Snow Days. That's why. Because she was like, hey, you have to watch this. So I did. Did you watch it? You haven't watched
no,
it?
No. Okay. I haven't. Can't. Last thing I really watched was Yellow Jackets. And that was last week.
I can't give anything away, but it's shocking. And you know what? He is, this is a perfect little segue, if you will. He is the perfect Anna Delvey. It's an exact female, male, same thing. Same
really?
Swindlers, cons, doing mm-hmm. what they do best. Yes. Yep. Watch both.
Awesome. And did you watch the Puppet Master one? There's something with the Puppet Master.
Which
another
one's
con
that?
Man, I think. The Puppet Master, Hunting the Ultimate Con Man. It's a harrowing docuseries. A cruel con man masquerading as a British spy manipulates and steals from his victims, leaving ruined families.
I think I did, but I don't think I finished it. I did. Okay. I started it, but I never
finished it. Yeah, those two are on my list, but I haven't been able to sit down and actually watch anything for a while.
Okay, so The Tender Swindler is true, and it features all of true stuff, and then Anna is fictional, but it's Julia Garner, the girl from Mozart.
But it's fictional based on fact.
Oh, it's true. Like I said, we, you and I, once you hear that, you'd be like, oh, okay. You'll remember it because we did listen to a podcast.
What was the podcast? Do you remember?
That was like 5-6 years ago, Jen. I couldn't tell you. Couldn't tell you. But I remember it because they went on vacation. So the 2020 interview is with the girl that went on vacation with her, and she got all her money back.
Oh, good. It's a plus.
Yeah, I guess so. But then there's other people that get taken for money when other people charge on their credit card and they don't get their money back. But okay. So she did. She got her money back. But it's not even that. Like, she pulled the hood over all of New York City. Let's put it that way. And she is very, like, you can't look away when you're watching her talk and stuff. Just like, I don't know. Huh. Actually, and I read
Is this a recent 2020 you said?
It's on there in like the last year, I guess. I'll send it to you because it's like your episode. No, I'll put it at the end of our thing because it is.
The show notes.
Yes, show notes. But the other thing I was going to say is that Julia Garner, the actress that plays her, I looked her up today because she has an accent and she nailed it. I think she nailed it. And then I wanted to know if her teeth were real because they look different than they do in Ozark, whatever. So that's the rabbit holes I go down when I watch this stuff. However, she went to go see her in Rikers Island and she was like, I was intimidated by her. And that's exactly, I think, how it comes across. Like, she has no, I think it was Diane Sawyer was interviewing her and there was like, no, she gives zero shits. She's like, why should I feel badly? And that it's true. Like, that's just how she is. So it's a movie character that is in real life, I guess. That's all I can say about that. Yeah.
Well, I love Julia Garner. I think she's great. I think she was the best thing in Ozark.
Well, and this is totally different. And that's why I looked up her teeth and stuff. I was like, she did a really good job. So, yeah.
That's it.
That's all I got for you, too, Jen.
That's all I got here, too. I just do want to say that we have a promo. Our promo this week is from our friend Debbie and her podcast, True Crime University. She is a listener to our show, so we should do her the favor and go listen to hers. Make sure to like and subscribe. And if you're in there, like and subscribe our show, too. That'd be awesome.
That would be. I
love it.
You know, the reviews.
Also, tell your friends.
And we've talked about this. The reviews make my heart sore. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I know I'm still like a
the good reviews. Yeah.
5 year old that gets happy that I had a red star on my paper. I'm sorry. Just makes me happy. That's all I got to say about that. Mm-hmm. So if you want to make Cam happy, I know what you need to know.
Cam needs the ego boost. Give her the ego boost, kids.
It's a small thing in life, getting that little star on your paper.
So anyway, right. listen to Debbie's promo and then make sure to subscribe.
Hey, but until then, Jen, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Vain. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
Hi, my name is Debbie, and I'm the host of True Crime University. I have a PhD in criminal justice and 17 years experience in law enforcement. I love teaching people about crime, criminology, and psychology. Join me in the classroom on Thursday nights on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Unfortunately, sometimes my pug Nathan has to get a word in. I just don't pay any attention to him. See you there.
At this point in time...